What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the Pentagon says the first shipments of a new U.S. military aid package have arrived at Ukraine's borders. Catalonia's pro-independence leaders accuse the Spanish government of conducting a mass surveillance campaign using an Israeli spyware. Plus, Palestinian resistance groups say their air defenses have confronted intruding Israeli aircraft in the Gaza Strip. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. As the war in Ukraine enters the third month, Russia's airstrikes have targeted a logistics center of the Ukrainian army near the city of Lviv. Russian Defense Ministry says a large number of foreign-made arms were stored in the targeted Ukrainian logistics center. The ministry says a repair center for the Tokayu missiles in the city of Drpino has also been destroyed. Meanwhile, the Pentagon says the first shipments of a new U.S. military aid package have arrived at Ukraine's border. Moscow had warned against unpredictable consequences if Washington continued supplying arms to Kiev. Ukrainian officials say Russian troops have taken control of the town of Kryvyi in the eastern Donbass region, where Russian forces have reportedly started a new offensive. The Ukrainian president and local officials say Russia is seeking to destroy Donbass in a large-scale offensive that it has begun.
We can now confirm that Russian troops have begun the battle for the Donbass, which they have been preparing for a long time. A large part of the Russian army is now dedicated to this offensive.
Vladimir Zelensky once again called for more sanctions on Russia's energy sector. He said the need for an embargo on Russian oil is growing every day. The Ukrainian president said Russia is openly using energy to destabilize Western societies. Moscow has pointed the incriminating finger at the European countries, saying their effort to cut dependence on Russian oil and gas would negatively affect the global market. Russia says that there is no replacement for its gas in Europe under the current circumstances. We talked to investigative journalist Tony Gosling in our special coverage of the war in Ukraine. He says Russia has managed to deal serious blows to the Ukrainian army so far.
Well, look, there's two things to say about this, really. One is the situation on the ground, and I suppose the other is the way it's been interpreted around the world. Because different parts of the world are seeing what's going on in Ukraine in very different ways, because that's the way the media are spinning it. You know, it's very difficult to find balanced reporting, because most parts of the world are either on one side or the other. But what we've seen here in London on the British media is really appalling. But in our newspapers and on the television, really what we're getting is only one side, and it really is, it's almost like a full-on propaganda war is going on, almost like it's, say, World War II, the sort of propaganda we would have got in World War II, where it's all very one-sided. But on the ground, and I think, you know, obviously things will be won and lost on the ground. They won't just be, you know, in people's hearts and minds. And so the change in manoeuvre of tactics by the Russians does seem to, you know, there have been a few important changes in what they've done, because they've succeeded in the first part of their plan, I think, which was basically to separate and break up the Ukrainian army so that it couldn't really communicate and it couldn't move as one against Russia and to attack on many fronts.
The Israeli spyware Pegasus is in controversy again. The leader of Spain's Catalonia accuses the central government of spying on the region using Pegasus following a failed 2017 referendum there. Pere Aragonès slammed what he calls Spain's use of Israeli spyware to target fundamental rights and democracy. He demands an explanation from the government in Madrid. A rights group known as the Citizens Lab says phones of dozens of pro-independence Catalan figures were infected with spyware. The group says it cannot attribute the operation to a specific entity, but there are strong evidence pointing towards Spanish authorities. The Citizen Lab says almost all of the infections took place between 2017 and 2020 in the wake of independence bid by Catalonians that plunged Spain into its worst political crisis. Israeli creator of Pegasus has rejected these allegations. The French presidential election has roared back to relevance as voters are upset over the inflation crisis. Many are upset with the austerity policies of President Emmanuel Macron, though others are also skeptical of his contender Marine Le Pen and her promises. Ramin Mazahari reports.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine. It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression. And the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Moving on, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip say their air defenses confronted intruding Israeli aircraft that targeted an area in the south of the besieged enclave. Israel says the airstrike came in response to a rocket fired into the occupied territories from Gaza. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent Eshef Shannon to get some updates.
Israeli fighter jets have attacked an area in this west of the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis, close to the Mediterranean. That location belongs to Hamas's military wing, the Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades. The bombing took place while Palestinians in Gaza were just getting ready to have their pre-dawn meals to prepare for the fasting for the holy month of Ramadan. In recent weeks, the Israeli regime has escalated attacks on Palestinians, whether in Al-Quds, in the occupied West Bank, or Gaza. Historically, the Israeli regime increases attacks on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan. We have also to remember that last year, also during the month of Ramadan, that was the 11-day Israeli war on Gaza, where scores of people were killed and injured, including dozens of children and women. And also earlier on Monday, Israeli tanks made a limited incursion east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beth Hanun. And also tonight, a young lady in the occupied West Bank succumbed to her wounds, who she was shot earlier by Israeli forces. So we see in recent weeks dozens of Palestinians being killed by Israeli regime forces, an increase in the hostilities against the Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, in Al-Quds, and especially in Al-Quds, as Palestinians are observing the holy month of Ramadan, which is one of the holiest months of the Islamic calendar.
Palestinians have held a funeral for a young girl who died of her injuries sustained during the Israeli attack in the occupied West Bank. 18-year-old Hanan Mahmoud Kadour was on her way home when she was injured by Israeli fire during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp just a few days ago. A spokesman for Hamas has described the killing as a heinous crime, saying the Zionist regime will not be able to undermine the Palestinian struggle for their legitimate rights. The northern West Bank city of Jenin has lately become the scene of an armed resistance campaign since earlier this month. Israeli forces have been attacking the refugee camp in Jenin, as well as other cities in the West Bank. The raids have left a large number of Palestinians dead or wounded, escalating tensions across the occupied territories. Iran's top human rights official has slammed the plan to burn the Holy Quran by a far-right group in Sweden. Qasem Gharibabadi says the country is turning into a prison for Muslims with the government support. In a tweet, the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights said religious intolerance is raging across Europe. Gharibabadi said the desecration of religious sanctities is under no circumstances acceptable. Several days of unrest in Sweden have left 26 police officers and 14 civilians injured. The unrest was triggered when the far-right Sverigedemokraterna party held a rally in a Muslim-dominated area of Sweden and tried to burn a copy of the Holy Quran. The party is known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances and intends to mobilize support ahead of the September elections. The group plans to publicly burn more copies of the Holy Quran. Police blame the violence on criminals who have no links to the demonstrations and are taking advantage of the situation.
Scuffles and unrest were reported in several spots across Sweden. Fierce clashes have broken out between police and protesters during demonstrations against a far-right group's intention to burn the Holy Quran. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Stram Kurs party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. Over a dozen police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. Meanwhile, police has backed the hardline party's plan, saying it would not revoke permission for a demonstration organized by the party. because the free speech threshold for doing that is very high in Sweden. That's why there have been reported clashes in locations that the Hardline Party either had planned or had demonstrations. Also, Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson came out in support of the far-right group, making remarks that have been deemed provocative. She said in Sweden, people are allowed to express their opinions whether they are in good or bad taste. That is part of our democracy.
This has nothing to do with free speech. In reality, this has to do with trying to get people's attention away from real problems by blaming everything on immigrants, blaming everything on Muslims, blaming everything on people who are not white. And this is something that it's very difficult to campaign against when these forms of racism and these forms of Islamophobia are protected by the quote-unquote right on free speech. And this is what we're seeing now.
These remarks only fanned the fire of unrest across the country and drew condemnations from the Muslim world, like from Iran. Iran summoned the Swedish envoy and condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying the blasphemy was committed under the protection of the Swedish police. Tehran said it would hold the Swedish government as accountable and expects an immediate reaction from Stockholm against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents. On Thursday, the Hardline Party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At the demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Strom Kurs is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances.
This is the idea that is used by the ruling elite in this country, in this continent, in Europe in particular, in North America as well, to justify every sort of insult, every sort of mockery, every sort of open racism, even when it is aimed at an ethnic minority, when it is aimed at another religious group, when it is aimed at a religion itself, when it is aimed at another race, when it is aimed at another culture or the people of the global south in general. This should all be accepted according to this ruling adagio. They say you have to accept it because it's part of free speech.
Instances of assaulting Islam, whether through officials or through publications, is rife in Europe. Take the instance of a great welder, a Dutch politician, who has made no bones about his hatred of Islam. Even French President Emmanuel Macron has publicly stated that he wants to reform Islam. And no one can forget the blasphemous cartoons by Charlie Hebdo, the magazine that depicted the Prophet Muhammad in a vulgar manner. And all of that under the guise of freedom of expression.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise across Europe in recent years in the wake of terrorist attacks in the continent, carried out mostly by Daesh sympathizers or the terrorist group's members who returned home following the group's defeat in Iraq and Syria. Muslim leaders in Europe and around the world have repeatedly condemned the terrorist attacks. Moreover, the rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have also exacerbated the status of religious minorities in Europe. Also, different sorts of bans on hijab in countries like Germany and France, as well as closure of mosques and religious centers, have further pressured the Muslim community in those countries. Add to it the discrimination in recruitment and provision of job opportunities, harassment at workplace, and hate speech. Also, hate crimes against Muslims are rife in Europe.
Absolutely, and that is where we have the issue that Islam and Muslims in general are always considered some sort of an external category, a separate category whose rights are not as absolute as the rights of other people, and especially if the rights of the secular, non-religious, atheist, white European, so to say.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Please.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. In these blessed moments and days, let us recite this prayer from the Quran. Our Lord, do not make our hearts swerve after you have guided us, and bestow your mercy on us. Indeed, you are the All-Munificent. Ramadan is the month of the Quran, and one of the main teachings in the Quran is the attention to the life after death, the life which is shaped by our deeds and is endless. The afterlife is so important that it has been mentioned in 1,200 ayahs of the Noble Quran. Moreover, in other ayahs, the calculation of our deeds on the Day of Judgment has also been mentioned in other ayahs. The ayahs of the Quran and the narrations of the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors reveal the fact that the Day of Judgment is a very hard and intolerable day. It is the day in which the sky is rent apart, the sun is wound up and turns dark, the stars are scattered and fall down, the mountains are set moving, the sky become like a hot metal. On this day, the trumpet or sur will be blown two times. The first time will cause all living creatures to die, and the second time will revive them to stand at the divine court of justice. God says that everyone's soul suffices as their own reckoner. This means that on the Day of Judgment, our deeds will be embodied. The tongue will be mute, and many witnesses, such as the angels, the infallible imams, and our body organs, will testify our deeds. Thus, none of us will be able to deny and conceal our sins. According to the Quran, on that day, everyone will escape from their near and dear ones. Even nursing mothers will leave their babies. In such unimaginable conditions, a beautiful and luminous companion will be very soothing. The Prophet's fifth infallible successor, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, says that when everyone stands in God's presence on the Day of Judgment, the reality of the Quran passes through the people as a radiant creature and is embodied before God. Then, it will intercede for those who have been habitual reciters of this book and practiced its teachings, and God will accept the intercession of the Quran. A hadith from the Prophet's 11th infallible successor, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, reads that on the Day of Judgment will appear with a beautiful face among people and will ask God for reward for those who used to respect it and fast in it. For sure, the recitation of the Quran in the blessed month of Ramadan is of special importance, as we have said many times. Meanwhile, the Prophet's fourth infallible successor, Imam Zainul Abidin, also known as Sajjad, peace upon him, looks at fasting in a different way. He says, "You should know that fasting is a curtain that God has put on your tongue, ears, eyes, and stomach to safeguard you against the hellfire." Dear listeners, these words are in fact the explication of the Prophet's hadith where he says, "Fasting is a shield against the hellfire." Imam Sajjad goes on to say, "So if your body organs gain calm behind this curtain, be hopeful that you are immune. But if you left them to continue their disorderly and irregular moves, pushing away the curtain, looking with sensuality and trespass the divine limits, then do not be immune of the curtains tearing up, because this is the outward of fasting, and what is important is the spirit and inward of it. In view of the fourth imam, a fasting person should not be content with mere abstention from eating and drinking. He should rather keep his eyes, ears, tongue, and other organs against evil deeds. He must not let his tongue utter evil words, insult, backbite, or calumniate others. He should also prevent his ears from listening to useless and forbidden sounds and words. This is true about his other organs too. As it has been mentioned before, our body organs are the doors to our heart. So, keeping them aloof from sins and evil deeds will guarantee the health of the heart. This is taqwa, or God-weariness, which has been mentioned in Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah as the fruit of fasting. In the second part of this program, we continue the discussion of the things that nullify fasting. It was said that thick dust nullifies fasting if it reaches the throat. This includes both edible dust like flour and dust of soil. The steam in bathroom or sauna does not nullify fasting unless it is so thick that turns into water drops and is swallowed. Most jurisprudents maintain that smoke of cigarettes and other tobacco products nullifies fasting, but the smoke of a car that reaches the throat accidentally does not nullify fasting. As for those who suffer from asthma and have to use a special spray, if the spray contains some medicine, it will nullify fasting. But if fasting is not possible or too difficult without the spray, the person can use it and it will not nullify fasting. Oxygen that is inhaled for artificial respiration does not nullify fasting as long as it is gas.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's well recognised that Western media outlets are consistently biased against the struggle of the Palestinian people. But how does this work in practice? In today's programme, we'll examine the impact of Zionist infiltration on the media. What role do Zionist journalists and organisations play in neutering independent coverage of Palestine? We'll be focusing on the situation in Britain and in Germany, and I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report on the infiltration of four British newspapers by Zionist activists.
People's ability to grasp what exactly is happening to the Palestinians is determined by what they read about it. What they read about it is dictated by those who write it. Today we take a close look at how key figures at the most prominent British newspapers are influenced by the Israel lobby. The Daily Mail, together with its website, The Mail Online, are estimated to reach 4.1 million people on a daily basis. very few are aware that its longtime city editor, Alex Brummer, is actually an Israel lobbyist. Simultaneous to his job at the Mail, he is also the chair of the Israeli regime-funded Abraham Initiatives, which claims in its trustees report that it advances synergy between Israeli bodies and respective agencies and institutions in the UK. Sounds like a lobby group, right? Well, here he is at Israel Lobby Group BICOM's We Believe in Israel event. Listen to what he says.
We need BICOM, we need the toolkit, and we need it urgently because, you know, there's a tide of opinion which has turned against Israel, and it's going to be very hard to turn it back.
The Sun newspaper is estimated to have a daily readership of 3.7 million and is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation Group. We know that in 2007, the News Corp Foundation was listed as a funder of the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in Israeli settlements. Murdoch himself also serves on the board of oil and gas exploration company Genie Energy. Genie Energy has been granted contracts by the Israeli regime in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. But what about the journalists at The Sun? Trevor Kavanagh, former political and later associate editor of The Sun, has a very close relationship with the Israel lobby group BICOM. He spoke at several We Believe in Israel events in support of the faction, and when he was criticized for lamenting what he called the Muslim problem in the UK, Israel lobbyist and part-time journalist Alex Brummer leapt to his defense. In the aftermath of Protective Edge, Kavanagh willingly stepped forward at a We Believe in Israel event that I chaired to staunchly make the case for Israel's actions and to criticize media bias. The Guardian is widely thought to be the progressive alternative to these right-wing class war rags. However, what we find is a newspaper which has been subjugated significantly by the Israel lobby. It has a daily readership of 3.5 million, and Jonathan Friedland was an executive editor there between 2014 and 2016, during which he also spoke at several BICOM events, including one named the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference, where he lovingly hosted a conversation session with current Israeli President Isaac Herzog. He has also spoken at events for the New Israel Fund and has his work publicly supported by the Israeli embassy in the UK. Sounds too close for comfort. Lastly, but never least, is the touchstone of the British establishment, the Times newspaper. It has a daily readership of almost 500,000 people. Brownman Maddox was the foreign editor of the Times, simultaneous to being a non-executive director of the Chatham House think tank, which is funded by the Israeli embassy. She later went on to be an editor of Prospect magazine, and simultaneously to that, hosted current Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, a part of the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference. Today, Maddox is the director of the Institute for Government think tank, which is funded by the Israeli government, and also Lord Sainsbury, who has pumped over £1 million into the Labour Friends of Israel lobby group. This is simultaneous to Maddox writing for the Financial Times, naturally. So here we have evidence of British newspapers with a collective daily readership of almost 13 million being staffed by people with what seems to be quite serious conflicts of interest. Nothing to see here.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic on Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dr. Ramzi Baroud. He's a journalist and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He's also authored five books. His latest one is called These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. Ramzi is a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs in Istanbul. And he joins us from Seattle, where it's very early in the morning. Welcome to the show. David, if I could just to start with you. Now, I heard a lot about this sort of propaganda network pushing certain lines in the media. Where's that directed from, do you think? And are there specific organizations behind it? And how is it being organized?
Well, you see these journalists who, if you like, are Zionist infiltrators in the media. And really, we should think of them as being that kind of character. They're not journalists who happen to have sympathies. These are people who are infiltrating on behalf of a hostile foreign state, the State of Israel. But there are also a number of other ways in which the State of Israel tries to influence the media in this country. Of course, there's the government, the State of Israel itself, which has its own propaganda and public relations apparatus, but they also have a number of organizations in this country, which are known usually as pro-Israel lobby groups. BICOM has been mentioned in the film there, and it's the main PR agency for in favor of Israel in this country. People think of it, as I said, as an Israel lobby group, but of course it's really an arm of the Israeli state. It functions very closely with the embassy and indeed with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, also with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs when it was in charge of anti-BDS activities in this country. So when you hear people at BICOM speaking, really what you're hearing is the messages that come from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You're not hearing some independent British Zionist organization. You're hearing the views of a hostile foreign state. And that's the important thing here. And what's important about the understanding propaganda networks is that they are there to direct particular sorts of messages which the infiltrators in the media, the journalists who happen to be Zionists, will pick up and spread.
Ramsey, I wonder if we could come to you now, if we can get you up on the screen. I wonder if you could maybe tell us about the situation in the media in the United States. And I mean, is this a problem, do you think, with the individual rogue Zionist journalists, or is it a systematic problem, do you think?
Of course, it's a very much a systematic problem. In fact, the United States kind of pretty much defined the genre of media bias, and they kind of brought it down to a science, more or less. On the one hand, you have this very idea of the very normal Israel. Israel is not being examined or not being tested in any way. Israel defines the narratives on democracy, or normalcy, on civilization, on human rights, and it's constantly in a state of self-defense. Now, this is not something that has happened overnight. It's an institutional propaganda that goes back many, many years, particularly after the war of 1967, and even in the early 80s with the rise of powerful lobby groups like AIPAC and others. While Palestinians are constantly being portrayed as the enemy, being portrayed not just as an enemy of Israel and therefore enemy of democracy and civilization and human rights, but also the enemy of everything that America stands for, the so-called American values. So in other words, the Americans have gone several steps ahead of everyone else in the West, which is linking the United States' interest with American interest, and therefore, Palestinians are seen as not just at odds with Israel, but also at direct odds with the United States, with its policies, and with, again, so-called American values.
So there's clearly a major issue there, then, that you're setting out, Ramsey. And yet, we hear about these situations like the columnist, what was her name, Barry Weiss, resigning from the New York Times, alleging anti-Semitism. She even talked about a new McCarthyism. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, if we think about it in terms of superstructures, if you think about Israel's presence in the United States media, academia, and of course government and foreign policy, you will find that they have created a new normal in which any form of criticism of Israel is not even allowed to be discussed, dissected, or anything. So in their minds, they feel like this is the normal. This is the status quo of thinking on this particular subject. Any deviation from that thinking, that for us is outrageous because it does violate all norms of fact-checking, good journalism, good common sense, but again, for them, it's a generational issue. Any criticism of Israel, be it, for example, emphasizing the latest Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports on Israeli apartheid and violations of human rights in Palestine, just the mere mention of that is considered, an act of anti-Semitism as far as the pro-Israel camp is concerned. So in other words, they are very spoiled in terms of their expectations, then they actually have no idea that they have already checked all the boxes and they have everything they want to have in terms of the dominance of their narrative over any others when it comes to Israel and the Middle East.
I mean, David, one of the worst outlets for this problem in the UK, certainly, and I think it's actually distributed in the United States as well, in any event, is The Guardian. Maybe you can say a little bit about The Guardian. I mean, what's happened to The Guardian? I mean, it used to be kind of seen as a, you know, kind of radical newspaper that sort of championed free speech, but it seems to have lost the plot, doesn't it?
Well, The Guardian has a long, long history of cozying up to imperial power and to the British state. But it had a period where it was more liberal, where it was able to do more investigative journalism. Of course, in recent years, they shut down their investigative journalism unit. And under the influence of someone like Jonathan Friedland, who, of course, is very strongly connected to the Israeli government, the Guardian has become much more pro-Israel and much less receptive to any kind of criticism of the state of Israel. They have a number of journalists in there who are in that kind of position. The chief political correspondent, for example, Jessica Elgott, who has risen from nothing, from working at the JC some years ago through the Huff Post, and into this role in The Guardian. She was on record recently at a Board of Deputies meeting saying that nobody should use the term Zionist. It's not allowed to use the term Zionist. And this is at the cutting edge of current Israel lobby thinking, that we can criticize the Israeli government, but we cannot use the word Zionist, and we cannot criticize the Zionist movement, which means, of course, we cannot criticize the actual activities of the Israeli government in this country. So someone like Elgott is clearly an ideologue for Zionism, but has this position in The Guardian, which is very senior, where people aren't really aware that there's a fundamental problematic nature to her approach.
Mm. I mean, we've heard a lot about BICOM, haven't we? I mean, it's often described as a sort of a pro-Israel group. I mean, would you say that's true, or are there more concrete links with the Israeli embassy?
Well, there are very concrete links with the Israeli embassy, indeed with the State of Israel itself, and indeed with the so-called Israel Defense Forces. The current head of BICOM is in the reserves of the Israel Defense Forces, which is an extraordinary situation. So when you hear BICOM speaking, and any of the people who speak on its platforms, like we've seen in the video there, what you're hearing is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Prime Minister's Office and the Israel Defense Forces speaking. This is straightforwardly an arm of the Israeli state.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for a moment, because we have another report looking at the apparent purge against Palestinian and Arab journalists in the German media.
Germany has a reputation for its refusal to allow open debate on the occupation of Palestine. But recently, disturbing signs of a purge of Arab journalists has emerged. Deutsche Welle is a publicly funded international broadcaster active in 32 languages. It is specifically regulated to be independent of government.
And I think it is time for the people of Germany and German elites to stop making Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip pay for the crimes of the German people against European Jews.
This all began in May 2021 when DW's English language division interviewed Electronic Intifada journalist Ali Abu Nima.
Palestinians are sick of paying the price for guilty German consciences.
The interview prompted an internal crisis at the broadcaster, which issued a public apology and a set of internal reporting guidelines specifying that Germany's path in carrying out the Holocaust means it has a special responsibility towards Israel. The memo banned its journalists from describing Israel as an apartheid state, a description affirmed by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and advising against the term colonialism. In June 2021, Matthias Duffner, chairman of the German publishing house Axel Springer, who describes himself as a non-Jewish Zionist, told employees who objected to raising the Israeli flag on the building's headquarters to find another job. In December last year, DW suspended its cooperation with Jordanian media partner Roya TV, following the emergence of allegedly anti-Israel comments published on social media by the broadcaster. But recently, the climate became more and more restrictive. In February of this year, 7 journalists were fired, and the head of news in the Arabic service resigned. All were Arabs, 6 of them Palestinian. The journalists resolved to take legal action. But it emerged that the investigation report allegedly compiled by experts had been written by individuals with serious conflicts of interest. One in particular was the Palestinian Ahmad Mansour. Mansour is a hardline Islamophobe, given to referring to Arabs as, quote, savages. He has worked with the hardline Likudnik think tank, the European Foundation for Democracy in Brussels, and is a staff member at the Zionist Intelligence Connected Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, occupied Palestine. Palestine Declassified can also reveal that a Deutsche Welle social media editor, Polina Gareev, who has been in post since April 2021, had a previous role in the Zionist entity as news editor of the official IOF magazine, Bamahan. In addition, the current Middle East editor at DW is Jennifer Hollis, previously at the Zionist lobby group, the Israeli-Swiss Association, in occupied Jaffa. Deutsche Welle has trashed its own reputation and shows no sign of independent reporting on Palestine. It's well known that Germany is a hostile place for the Palestinian cause, but recent events emphasize the need for fundamental reform of journalism and the media.
David, I wonder if you could first off start by telling us a little bit about this social media guru, what was her name, Polina Gareev, I think I've pronounced her name correctly.
Yes, so this is something which we have discovered, that I think even the journalists who were sacked at Deutsche Welle weren't aware of, that she had previously worked for the IDF's own magazine, a magazine set up prior to the creation of the State of Israel for the Haganah, the armed group which was involved centrally in the Nakba. She also works, I think, for the Israel Policy Institute, which, of course, is funded directly by the Israeli state. This is an extraordinary conflict of interest. And, of course, not one which the German media will be likely to pay much attention to, but which throws a great deal of light on the way in which these journalists have been so shoddily treated. So I think that's a really significant thing. It's the same situation as we've found, effectively, in the British media, that there are Zionist infiltrators, effectively, throughout the mainstream media. And Deutsche Welle, I remember, is a public broadcaster, like the German equivalent of the BBC World Service. It's supposed to be independent of states. And they've sacked all these journalists, seven journalists sacked, one of them resigned. And they've got these other people in there, like Polina and several others, who used to work directly for the Zionist movement or the Israeli state. Extraordinary.
Talking about conflicts of interest, what about this character Ahmed Mansour that was mentioned in the film? He seems to have a very significant conflict of interest, doesn't he?
Well, we come back again, don't we, to the same issue we had with the British media, which is that there is this network of hawkish think tanks which are pushing people forward to be experts in the media, which are issuing statements and which are, you know, trying to infiltrate the media institutions themselves. I mean, the connections he has there with the European Foundation for Democracy, which is a hard-line Likudnik think tank in Brussels, which is funded almost entirely by the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C., which is itself, as admitted by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, an asset, an agent, effectively, of the government in Jaffa. So there's a real issue there. He's also been associated with the IDC, the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which, of course, has a strong connection to both elite special forces in the IDF and indeed to the Israeli intelligence services. Something like 20% of places are reserved for such people to go to this university. So this is a person who is well connected straight to the Israeli state and who is performing a role of a kind of state-sanctioned Islamophobe, going around condemning Arabs as savages and trying to suggest that Arab journalists are anti-Semitic. Now, there's no such thing going on here. What we're seeing is an attempt to intimidate and occupy public service broadcasters and indeed the private press to make sure that there can be no criticism of the state of Israel.
And Ramzi, I mean, obviously the situation in Germany is pretty dire. I mean, do you think that the United States is more open to dissent on Palestine, maybe, than Germany is?
Well, I think there are the historical sensitivities that are, at work in Germany makes the nature of the conversation there, I mean, stifles it all together. The points that Ali Abu Naima raised is really something quite serious, and they have to be considered, and they have to be at the core of this discussion. But of course, that is just simply impossible in Germany. And I personally experienced both Germany and Austria particular situations in which you know, I had talks canceled, venues canceling on me last minute, and one particular visit to Austria, four different venues canceled on me, and we had to scramble into a cafe shop last minute to bring people there to speak about Palestine. So the very idea of discussing Palestine within a sympathetic point of view in these countries is problematic. So this is something that goes beyond media into civil society, into academia, and into other venues. Now, in the United States, is different business. Again, because you have this massive infrastructure of think tanks that have been at work for a long time, particularly after 9/11 also, we have kind of seen this amalgamation of narratives where basically Israel became an American platform to fight terrorism, so-called terrorism, and the way that Israel played so very well on this particular aspect. You have characters, for example, like Daniel Pletchka from the American Enterprise Institute, one of many institutes, but people like her, her connections and friendships with Netanyahu and other members of the U.S. Israeli government, but also her relationship and connections to the American ruling elites, particularly within the neoconservative movement. And we know how the neocons and the Israelis have worked so very well together. And yet when they appear on American media, whether Fox or CNBC or even CNN, they are not seen as people who represent Israel per se or Israeli point of view. They come across as normal, concerned American intellectuals, academics, analysts, and they offer a point of view that is supposedly uncorrupted by these kind of sinister connections. And this is what we really have to deal with here at quite often. I mean, you might find this is quite strange, but when I first came to the UK years and years ago, I was actually impressed with how British media once in a while allowed some kind of a Palestinian or sympathetic Palestinian voice, to the point that my British friends would say, what are you talking about? They are ridiculously biased. And of course, it took me time to understand that within the British context. But the reason I felt that is here in America, we are completely erased. We are completely marginalized to the point that if you are as a Palestinian or a pro-Palestinian voice to get published in a respected American newspaper, you would have to watch everything you say. You would have to water down your language to the point that almost the language becomes emasculated. And in fact, this is the reason of why I veered off completely in a sort of chasing after the Washington Post and the New York Times to publish an article once a year or two or three. You know, we invested more in alternative media, because that's really the only way that you can reach even the margins of American audiences and society. But it is far more beneficial and rewarding process than actually try to get the American media to pay any heed to your point of view.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Ramsey. But thank you very much indeed. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We could have gone on, obviously, for a lot longer. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
The ongoing attempts to take over Muslim holy places, whether in Al-Quds, Al-Khalil, or in Nablus, continue apace, as does valiant Palestinian resistance to them, says Joseph Massad, journalist, in an article published under the heading How Zionism is Fueling a Religious War Over Al-Aqsa Mosque. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist Jewish Colonial Fundamentalist Group, the Returning to the Mount, which advocates the construction of a third Jewish temple in Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest place in Islam, and is associated with the racist Catch Group, announced recently that it plans to sacrifice animals as part of the Jewish Passover rituals on Friday, April 15th in Haram al-Sharif. In response, Hamas declared that it will not allow such rituals to take place and will prevent them at any cost. The Palestinian Authority and the Jordanian government also condemned the plans. Palestinian worshippers insisted on remaining in the mosque recently to prevent the extremist Zionist group from entering Al-Haram and were attacked by the Zionist regime forces, who injured more than 100 Palestinian worshippers. Just before 2003, the Zionist regime began to allow no more than 3 religious Jews to visit Al-Haram at a time, but since then has steadily increased that number to more than 50, and does so without the approval of the Islamic Waqf authorities. By 2009, after making racist remarks about Palestinians, the Zionist regime's internal security minister, Yitzhak Aharonovich of the right-wing Yisrael Beitenu party, paid yet another visit to Al-Haram. More Zionist provocations and desecrations continued. In September 2015, the Zionist regime prevented Palestinians from entering Al-Haram to make way for Jews